Hi, everyone. It looks like we have a few more folks who have joined us. I want to thank you so much for taking the time out of your day to join the Interfaith Immigration Coalition on our monthly webinar. This month's webinar is on civic engagement, a faithful call to stand in solidarity with immigrant and refugee communities this election cycle. We're really excited to have you all here with us. We all know that this election so far has had a lot of discussions around immigrants and refugees, and a lot of it has been really negative. And so what we're going to talk about today is what we can do as a faith community to really push back and really lift up the voice and the priorities of immigrant and refugee communities in our nation. We are really excited to have a great group of speakers today with us. One of them is Lindsay Hodel. She is the National Field Director for Nonprofit Vote. Another is Mo Kant. He is a new American and first-time voter this election season. Another was Julie Emery. She is the Executive Director of State Voices in Virginia, part of their civic engagement table. Adamu Muhammad, he is a grassroots organizer with Church World Service. And Adam Waters, he is an Eisendrath Legislative Assistant at the Religious Action Center of Reform Judaism. So without further ado, we are going to go ahead and begin. I'm going to go ahead and turn this over to Lindsay, who is going to be speaking to us about how congregations and nonprofits can engage people this election cycle and do it in a way that is nonpartisan and doesn't go out of the bounds of what we can do as 501c3s. So, Lindsay, go ahead, take it over.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, everyone, for joining us today, and I hope everybody is having a great Monday. My name is Lindsay Hodel. I'm the National Field Director for Nonprofit Vote. And for those of you who are less familiar with Nonprofit Vote, our mission is to partner with America's nonprofits to help the people they serve participate and vote. And so we work with national and state partners like the Boys and Girls Club, the United Way, the YWCA and YMCA networks, the National Association of Community Health Centers, and a group of more than 120 national and state partners who all believe that the nonprofit sector needs to and can be a formidable force in elections and in the electoral and political landscape. And so just a little bit about me, I'm based out of Denver, Colorado. The rest of my team is in Boston, so we definitely have a national team. And I am actually just wrapping up a Master's of Divinity degree at Iowa School of Theology, and so definitely am driven and inspired by my faith, and that is one key piece that really helps me stay grounded in the political arena. So that's just a little bit about me. Why don't we dive in to talk a little bit more about what nonprofits can and can't do around the elections. And of course, as an extension of that conversation, our congregations and our church partners as 501c3 designated organizations are also regulated by the same rules and regulations that nonprofit service providers or nonprofits more in general would also be regulated by. And there are a few specific resources for congregations that I'll mention before I stop talking today. But just to give you some context in that, I'll be referencing a lot throughout the next couple minutes 501c3 organizations and what they can and can't do. And so just know that whether you are with a church, a congregation, a parachurch organization, or a nonprofit, these rules are very similar. So just a little bit about what I'll be speaking about today. First of all, I would like to start with the one basic rule that the IRS gives all of us as 501c3 organizations around election activities and what we can and can't do. I'll then talk a little bit more about voter engagement activities at work, so within our congregations, within our nonprofits, for our staff and for our volunteers. And then lastly, I'll speak just very briefly about political activities outside of work or as, you know, citizens or community members, when we're not representing our organizations or our congregations, but maybe representing just ourselves as individuals. So that's the basic agenda that I'll be speaking about today. And if you do have any questions or want clarification, then definitely save. I think we'll need to save those questions for the end. But definitely, I want to hear from all of you on the call as well. So next slide. So the one basic rule that the IRS gives us, and this is, we've pulled this language directly from the IRS website, and so if you want the link to more information that the IRS provides, I'm happy to provide that after the webinar today. The IRS is actually incredibly helpful and incredibly clear on this topic. And in my experience, I found that the information is very easily understood and is more clearly and easily presented than perhaps some other information that the IRS may try to provide us, for instance, around our taxes. So the one rule for a 501c3 nonprofit organization or a 501c3 congregation or church is that C3 organizations may not support or oppose a candidate for public office. That's the one basic rule. So congregations may not make an endorsement of a candidate, either pro or against. They may not donate money or resources. So resources could be defined as things like photocopies and paper for flyers. It could mean phone lines for a phone bank. Anything essentially of value may not be donated to a candidate or a partisan campaign. And we also may not rate candidates on our particular issues because, of course, those who we would rank higher, that would be sort of an implicit endorsement. We'd obviously be, you know, endorsing that candidate more highly than others. Or opposing, you know, some of the candidates that we rank kind of on the lower end of the scale. So that's the one basic rule that governs electoral engagement by the 501c3 or the nonpartisan sector, which again is a nonprofit or a congregation. The good news, next slide, please. The good news is that there are a ton of other activities that are permissible that the IRS actually encourages and allows nonprofits to engage in. And so, again, this comes from the IRS, and they encourage and allow 501c3 nonpartisan organizations to conduct activities like voter registration, voter education, candidate engagement and education, and get out the vote campaigns, as long as we are doing that work in a nonpartisan way, which again takes us back to that one basic rule that we may not either oppose or endorse a candidate for public office. So next slide, please. I'm going to go into a few more details about a couple of these activities. So what nonprofits can do? We may conduct nonpartisan voter engagement activities that are designed to help the public participate in elections. So next slide. So let's look a little bit more specifically at voter registration. So we as nonpartisan congregations or nonprofits can promote voter registration through our communications and events to announce registration deadlines, where to register, and we can even directly support voter registration activities or conduct our own voter registration drives. This could include setting up a table in a lobby. It could be passing around voter registration information after a service, including voter registration in church activities and youth groups and in other ministry and outreach activities. As I mentioned, holding a specific voter registration event or drive, even for our own staff and volunteers. The one rule when it comes to voter registration is that we may not suggest which party to join or which candidate to vote for. And that probably seems a little common sense, but it's definitely important to note because in my experience, in particular when registering first-time voters, sometimes there's a lack of clarity or a lack of awareness about which party does what and which party supports which issues. And I've often been asked by voters, which party should I affiliate with? And so that's where I, as a nonpartisan voter registrar, need to say, I'm a nonpartisan, I'm with a nonpartisan effort, and I can't encourage you to affiliate with any particular party. What we can do is explain what affiliation with a party means, and also explain that there is an option to register unaffiliated. So next slide. So when we look at voter education, after we conduct registration work and we want to make sure people have the information they need to go and vote, there are two kinds of voter education work that we usually recommend considering for nonpartisan efforts like ours. The first kind of voter education is educating voters on the process itself of voting. So this includes providing the date of the election, polling place hours, what ID they may need to vote, etc. And it's important to remember that for first-time voters or for infrequent voters, the process of voting may actually be fairly intimidating. And we as nonprofit leaders and nonpartisan voices can be a trusted messenger for helping to explain the process of voting and proactively answer any questions voters may have. The second kind of voter education that you may consider is educating voters on candidates and issues. Now, we need to keep in mind our one basic rule that we can't oppose or endorse candidates, but we can provide nonpartisan voter guides and sample ballots so that voters are educated on what they will actually see when they get their vote by mail, their absentee ballot, or when they go to the polls. Who may be on the ballot, and we can even talk about what some of the candidate stances on various issues are. I don't have time today to go into detail on how to stay nonpartisan when you are conducting candidate forums and when you are creating voter guides, but please visit our website at nonprofitvote.org to find a lot more information on those specific pieces, and we have some great fact sheets and actually toolkits to help you create nonpartisan candidate questionnaires or host a nonpartisan candidate forum. Essentially, the one basic rule here is that voter guides must be balanced and can't compare your position with the candidates. That would go into ranking candidates, which we've already talked about a little bit before this slide. So next slide, please. So moving on to candidate engagement, we as nonpartisan congregations can invite candidates to an event, sponsor a candidate forum, prepare candidate questionnaires and distribute them to our parishioners or community members, and we can also educate candidates on our policy ideas. The couple rules to keep in mind in staying nonpartisan is to first of all include all candidates in your outreach. Not all have to participate. Sometimes candidates don't respond to candidate questionnaires or invitations, but you do have to invite all viable candidates in any given race to have the same opportunity as any other candidate. So to appear in front of community members, parishioners, et cetera, or to participate in a candidate questionnaire or forum. It's a good idea to document those invitations either through email or through snail mail, just so you have a paper record indicating that you have invited all candidates. And then lastly, as I mentioned, you can review more nonpartisan guidelines on each of these activities at nonprofitvote.org. Next slide, please. So lastly, when we think about get out the vote efforts, so now that we have registered individuals and educated them, it is time to get out the vote and make sure that people are voting either on election day or earlier through early voting or voting by mail. So a couple considerations to consider, or a couple recommendations to consider when you're thinking about your Get Out the Vote or GOTV programs. First of all, nonpartisan congregations can create visibility. So making the election visible at your, and this should probably say your congregation, or at an agency or a fellow nonprofit. We can help people vote and be on hand to help people vote early or answer any questions they may have. And then we can also encourage people to get out and vote and contact all of our constituents about voting and answer any questions they may have. And we always are very fond of saying here at Nonprofit Vote that we may not endorse candidates, but we can and we should endorse voting. So next slide, please. And then one particular note around ballot measures. If you are in a state where you have ballot measures, 501c3 nonprofits and 501c3 congregations may endorse or oppose a ballot measure as a lobbying activity. So this is not considered an electioneering or a partisan activity. Saying vote yes or vote no on a particular ballot measure is considered lobbying by the IRS and not does not cross the line into anything that would be deemed partisan in an election sense. So that's a really important distinction and something that there may be a lack of clarity around among your constituents or among your organization or congregation. So again, activity on ballot measures is considered lobbying because it's influencing the passage or defeat of a piece of legislation or a law, not the election of a candidate. So that's the key distinction there. Next slide. So I mentioned a couple resources that are available at Nonprofit Vote. And we are actually in the process of revamping our online clearinghouse and online library, but it is still a very great resource to check out now, even as we're maintaining those or making those updates. So we have more information and more resources on candidate engagement, more information on how to stay nonpartisan, as well as some of the other topics that you see on your screen depicted by those great icons. Next slide. So just a couple pieces to consider, which if we could scoot back a little bit on those slides. So just a quick note on political activity outside of work, and then I'll turn the presentation back to my counterparts. Nonprofit staff members, we, of course, while on the job, cannot oppose or endorse candidates for public office, but outside of our jobs as a pastor, as a program officer, as a program manager, as a nonprofit executive director, we, of course, don't lose our First Amendment right to freedom of speech and freedom of political speech when we are off the clock. And so that's the key distinction is thinking through, you know, are we doing this on the clock, representing our organizations or our churches, or are we doing these activities as an individual outside of work? So next slide. So the basic guideline for nonprofit staff or congregational staff is that we can engage in the elections, and we can do partisan work as long as we are representing ourselves as individuals instead of our organizations. So outside and off the outside of work and off the clock, we can volunteer on campaigns, attend political events, actually directly support candidates. We can even run for office. And when can we do these activities? We can engage in these kind of activities on personal time, outside of work hours, on vacation, on personal days, or on unpaid leave. So that's the key distinction is who we're representing and whether we are on work time or not. So next slide. And what to avoid, of course, is using your nonprofit or your congregational resources for partisan activities. So that would include your time, but also include some of the other resources I mentioned earlier, things like a phone line or phone lines for a phone bank, paper for photocopies, food, for instance. We want to avoid using our organizational resources for partisan political purposes. And we also want to avoid being partisan when representing our nonprofit at or outside of work. So next slide. And just a few other resources. And again, our website, because it's a great resource where I think many of your questions can be answered, at nonprofitvote.org. And of course, my information, I think we can go ahead and share that after the webinar as well. If you just want to pick up the phone and have a conversation, and if you'd like to talk any more about questions you may have or any plans that you want to sort of run by somebody. The last resource I'll mention, and I didn't create a slide for this, is to consider contacting the Alliance for Justice or visiting their website for more in-depth information on how to stay nonpartisan. And the Alliance for Justice also has a hotline that you can call and ask questions with actually staffed attorney. They won't give you legal advice, and they're very clear about that, but they will help you maneuver. For instance, if you get a question from a candidate or you have a specific question about, is this nonpartisan, is this crossing the line, that lawyer, hotline is a great resource where you can get those questions answered, and they usually do so within 24 hours. So I'll go ahead and just say that that phone number, and then we'll make sure to send it out in the information following the webinar. And that number is NP for nonprofit, 866-NP-LOBBY. So again, 866-NP-LOBBY. And that's what I had in terms of a presentation today. I'll go ahead and turn it over to my counterparts to move us forward.
Thank you, Lindsay. That was so great. And for anyone who was frantically trying to write everything down, don't you worry. This is all being recorded and will be available online afterward. I know some of you mentioned in the chat box that you actually were not getting any sound, so you do actually have to call in for that. So if you missed it and joined the audio portion a little bit late, it is being recorded and you'll be able to get all of that online afterward. Also through that chat box, you guys can insert any questions that you want to ask later at the end during the Q&A portion. You'll also be able to ask in person if you would like, but if you want to go ahead and ask a question, then we can call on you later. Up next is Mo Kant. He is a new American and first-time voter this year, and he's going to share with us just a little bit about his story and what it means to him to be able to finally vote this year. So, Mo, I'll go ahead and hand that over to you. Just press *6 to unmute yourself.
Hi, we can hear you.
Okay, great.
Go
ahead.
First of all, thank you for having me here. My name is Mo. I'm a first-time voter, currently residing in New York. I was actually immigrated to America, United States, in September of 2008, and I landed in Greenville, South Carolina. I was able to come here because my father was granted political asylum, and he was able to bring me, my sister, and my mom. And we were all granted green cards or permanent citizenship within the year of our arrival. And I went through the naturalization process for 5 additional years, and I just received my citizenship last November. So I'm pretty proud of that. Yes. So basically, when I first got here, it was election year, and, you know, Obama won the elections, and we had no idea what's happening. Basically, we were just excited to be seeing democracy, you know, in real life. So coming from a country where our military government was what I know for the my entire life, experiencing the democracy for the first time was pretty exciting for me. Yes. So up until last year, Burma was actually a military state, and now they have actually had their first democratic election. So I'm pretty excited about that, too, for people back home. And now it's basically my turn. So this year I will be able to vote since I'm 21 and I'm a citizen now. So personally, you know, I'm very excited about this. And I'll not only take this as a duty, as a civic duty, but as a privilege. Yeah. So that's a short story about me. Anna?
Yes, thank you, Mo. I hope that actually maybe serves to to inspire all of us listening, that I think it is something that many immigrants and refugees who have waited for so long to be able to vote, that it is something that we want to do. And I hope it encourages somebody to get out there and help immigrant and refugee communities work their way towards citizenship so they are given that right. So now we're actually going to turn it over to Julie Emery, who is the Executive Director of State Voices Virginia Civic Engagement Table, and she's going to talk to us a little bit about what kinds of activities we can do this election cycle. So, Julie, take it away.
Thank you very much. As Diane mentioned, my name is Julie Emery, and I am the Executive Director of the Virginia Civic Engagement Table here in Virginia. The Virginia Civic Engagement Table is part of the State Voices National Network. There are 20 similar tables throughout the country. Before I tell you any more about what we're doing in Virginia, just a quick note about myself. So I've been doing this work specifically with Virginia Civic Engagement Table for 2 years now. Before that, I worked as the political director with SDIU here in Virginia. But my faith background is much deeper than my political background. I come from a family where we came from the Christian tradition. Faith was a critical part of who we were growing up. We often had Bible studies after supper in the evening around the kitchen table. Two of my siblings went on to marry people in the ministry, and I actually went to a Christian college myself. Faith has always played a central role in my life. So I'm so excited that I am part of this call today. So thank you all for being here. So the Virginia Civic Engagement Table is a collection of 40-plus progressive nonprofits here in Virginia. We come together around two core beliefs, and those beliefs are that our democracy works better when everyone is engaged with that democracy. That obviously, for the purpose of this phone call, includes voter registration and voting, but it also includes holding elected officials accountable once we've elected them to office. And so we work with our partners to make sure that they are doing this deep civic engagement work, but also we know that it is very difficult to, when the policy changes, the changes in our society that we think are so important. And so we want folks to work together in collaboration because it is almost impossible to make the real change we want in the world by ourselves. So that's a little bit about who we are as a table. What we know about minority turnout in elections is that the traditional methods that parties have used or that candidates have used often fail. And what they have traditionally done is they show up at someone's door or the phone rings at the last minute. GOTV typically is the last weekend before the Tuesday election. So someone shows up at your door and says, "Can we count on you to vote? Thank you very much." And they call your home and say, "We need you to vote. Here's your polling place." Even if you use some of the more recent research data and ask people to make an actual plan to vote, which is one of the most important things you can do, that alone is not enough when you are talking to new Americans, to immigrant communities and minority communities. What the research shows is actually that you have to have multiple conversations with this electorate, that messenger matters. So who has these conversations is critically important. So if we can move on to the next slide. So the first thing is removing barriers. So if you are a new American, newly registered, it is entirely possible that English is not your first language. And so all of the information that you are getting about this election may be in a language you don't actually speak or understand. And so removing barriers simply on the education side so that folks understand not just who the candidates are, but what issues people are talking about and what issues the candidates are talking about and where they stand on those issues. So there is a lot of work that can be done by nonprofits and by the faith community in just simply helping people understand. We often see this, especially in, for example, here in Northern Virginia, there is a large Korean population and a lot of Korean Christian churches that can do amazing work in this area, very important work. We also know that the messages matter. And so just as you would in talking to any individual, it's not enough to say, so I've decided that what is important to me in this election is climate change, and therefore that's what I'm going to talk to everybody about. And even if that person doesn't particularly care about climate change, and that's what not what would motivate them to vote. So just as with any other voter, the message matters. What you are talking about matters. And so making sure that you are taking the time when you are talking to people about engaging in our political process to find out from them what matters. Why would you want to vote in this election? What policies are you concerned about? What are you thinking about as we go into the November elections? So it's very important to hear from them what matters and then to make sure that when you engage them around participating, that you are echoing those messages back to them. So you told me that the most important thing to you is schools in our community, and so I want to let you know that elections matter in terms of schools, and those are important conversations that people often don't take the time to have. Again, this is a place where nonprofits and the faith community can be very influential and very helpful, just in giving forums, providing forums for this kind of information, deep dives into particular issues. We know that voters who feel more educated on the issues are more likely to actually turn up and vote. And people who feel like they do not understand the election or the issues involved in the election are more likely to stay home. So it matters. Messenger also matters. So often what we find, campaigns, political parties will send people to the doors of a potential voter who look nothing like them, who share nothing about their culture, their background, and who just view this often as another door to knock on. And so it matters if people who have connections with them, who come from the same culture, potentially speak the same language, are the people delivering this message about the importance of civic participation. It doesn't, you know, if I am from Ireland, it doesn't have to be someone from Ireland. If I am from Syria, it doesn't have to be someone from Syria. But someone who comes from a similar background is definitely a more trusted messenger. And I will, research shows that I will pay more attention to that message from that messenger than I will from someone who I don't have anything in common with. This is even more true with people I have relationships with. So here again is a place where the faith community can play a hugely influential role. If I am a member of your congregation and you tell me as my faith leader, my spiritual leader, that civic participation and voting are important, that is much more likely to resonate with me and lead me to act than some random person off the street talking to me about this. So messenger matters. And then the quality and the quantity of the interaction matters. And this is true more with new Americans specifically than with any other category of voter. So whereas someone who has voted their whole life, if you show up at their door once or make one phone call and remind them to vote, that may be enough. what we've seen with new Americans is that it can often take 6 or 8 contacts with a potential voter to persuade them that this is important, that there are not barriers that will keep them from voting, that they won't be intimidated or embarrassed in the process. And these are not short conversations, again. So it's the quality of that conversation. These are longer conversations, again, than just, you know, showing up to a person who's 45 years old, has voted in multiple elections, they know the system well. You just show up and say, don't forget, this is where you vote, this is when you vote, this is the date you vote, and that's perhaps maybe all you need to say. With new Americans, it is important to have that longer, deeper conversation about what the process looks like, what they may encounter their first time at the polls, and make sure that you have that conversation more than once, and possibly include more family members, because often you will find that households will be having deep conversations about what this election means, and that because they are often more extended family, that opinions within the family are more important. And you guys probably know all this more, even better than I do, but so making sure that the quality and the quantity of those conversations are more than you would with perhaps an American voter who's been part of the process, a U.S.-born voter who's been part of this process for a long time. So being aware of all that matters. And then again, the more personal, relationships matter. Folks having conversations with people they know and trust is more likely to result in civic participation. All right, so the next slide. So the Virginia Civic Engagement Table, the civic engagement is an important part of what we do, and encouraging our partners to do that is very important. So one of the things we do is educate our partners on what they can and cannot do as 501c3s, and you just got a great presentation on that, so you have more information on what you can and can't do. We're here as a resource for people. For our partners, if they run into a situation where we would like to do this but just aren't sure if that's something that's legally allowable, we have access to experts. We've been doing this a long time, and we can consult with them. We can point them to the right authorities if we don't have that information ourselves. We also provide the kind of education we've just been talking about in terms of what works and what doesn't in reaching out to voters. If you have X number of dollars to do this work and you're going to invest in it, are you better off going door to door? Are you better off making phone calls? Are you better off doing mailings? So we have that access to that research and share that on a regular basis with the partners at our table so that when they do this work, they are more effective at it. And then coordination. Because we have over 40 nonprofits who are engaged in this civic engagement work, doing voter registration, doing get-out-the-vote work. What we want to make sure is that not everybody is going to the same 1,000 voters in, let's say, Arlington, Virginia. We want to make sure that we all are talking to as many voters as possible. And so if you're going to talk to 1,000 new, let's say, voters from Mexico in Arlington, we want someone else talking to 1,000 Korean voters in Arlington. And we want to make sure that we are looking at the whole population and deciding who's covering which voters so that we're not all showing up at the same door and actually doing more harm than good because people get annoyed. You know, if you are in a swing state like Virginia, especially during the election season, you can get, you know, 30 phone calls in a couple weeks, it seems like, and that can be annoying, and you can stop answering your phone and stop talking to people. So we want to make sure that we're getting this right. We also provide data support. So there are tools available. The one we use most often is called VAN, Voter Activation Network, and it actually provides information on who voters are and where they live. So it's not going to tell me who you voted for in the last election, but it will tell me if you voted. It may give me your phone number if that's publicly available. It will definitely give me your address or at least the most recent one that you registered with. And so that allows us to figure out where are the voters that we most think we need to talk to make sure that they show up and vote. And so we have an expert on those data tools who is available to freely consult with any of our partners and help them put together a plan for voter engagement that makes sense both with the amount of resources they have and helps them figure out where they can have the most impact. And again, coordinating that with other partners. We can also help partners if they want to work together. So one group may say, we have 10 volunteers, but we want to cover 5,000 voters, and we know we can't do that with 10 volunteers. Maybe some other organization wants to work with us to talk to these folks. And then sharing learnings. Because we are so many organizations, we are all doing different things in different ways, there's an opportunity after each election cycle, certainly, to sit down together and say, what worked, what didn't, what would you do differently next time, and what can you share with folks that might help them improve the programs that they run and the work they do with people. And so we do that on a regular basis after each election cycle, but there's also opportunities to do this during the cycle where we have regular phone calls with people, conference calls, where they can tell us what's happening in the field as they're out knocking doors or as they're making phone calls. We're running into a lot of voters from this particular ethnic group who speak this language and don't speak much English, and we don't have any way to talk to them. Does anyone else have information on how we could bridge that gap? So those are the kind of things that we try to share with each other so that we can help and be more effective in the work we do and turn out more voters and get more people civically engaged. Last slide, please. So if you are in Virginia, I know there are a lot of you on this call from all over the country, but if you happen to be in Virginia and I can be helpful, if you're interested in more information on the table and how we can help with your program, please reach out to me. My email address is there. If you are in another state and would like to connect with the civic engagement table there, the State Voices table, the State Voices website actually has a drop-down list of all the states that are covered in their network and how to contact those tables. And again, they exist to make sure that more voters are part of this system, and they are almost always happy to connect with you and provide any resources they're able to. And I am happy to hand it back to Diane and take any questions when we get to that point of the program.
Thank you, Julie, so much. All right, so we are a little bit behind schedule, so we are just going to move right along to Adam Muhammad, who is going to share with us just a little bit about his experience in working with refugees on election issues. So, Adam, I'll send that right over to you. You can just press *6 to unmute yourself.
Yes, can you hear me now?
Yes.
Yes. So I was on mute, sorry. Yes, thank you again for having me on this webinar on civic engagement. My name is Adamu Mohammed. I am originally from Niger, West Africa. I work as a grassroots organizer with Church World Service. The goal of our civic engagement work is to develop and empower, i.e. giving refugee and immigrants the tools they need as leaders in civic engagement, community organizing, and team building as part of the larger goals of building welcoming communities. This slide you're looking at is basically one of our training that we held in Harrisburg, Virginia. That was back in July of last year, where we had different community represented from West Africa to Asia, Iraq, Syria, etc. So the part of our work is training refugee and immigrant leaders, and we have been involved in at least 5 states in 8 different cities across the United States, training refugee leaders how to build leadership and also making sure that they are more civically engaged in their community. And so why is this important for naturalized immigrants to vote? One thing that we understand that integration is a key goal of our work. So civic engagement through voter registration and voter education is a critical piece of this, of integration. So when naturalized immigrants and refugees exercise their right to vote, they empower themselves to be full members of their new community. So the more involvement refugees have in their community and voting for people that represent their view, that also will be champion of issues that impact their community. So the more they vote, the better representation they have in the community, and the more influence and they will have that to have also develop more inclusive public policies in the community. And voting is key, of course, because in our training, what we try to demonstrate is that politicians tend to listen to two people, two groups of people, either voters and donors. So while we are not that rich, we know that we have that power to vote people in or vote them out with our vote. So that is why we emphasize that voting is really critical in the work we do. Let's go back. And also, talking about the legacy of our vote, we try to go back in history and demonstrate that the right we enjoy today as immigrants and refugees or new Americans, you know, did not come on a platter of gold, that people have sacrificed their lives for us to be where we are today, and so we must not let that go as, in waste. So also addressing past trauma and anxiety about voting. This point is very important for us immigrants and refugees because back in where we come from, many people have experienced political violence, and that trauma and that experience really defines the way they view politics in the United or everywhere. So it's for us as new Americans to really, and also organizations, faith communities, to educate and reassure refugee and new Americans who are voting that here in America, your vote really counts and does count, and political violence is something of the past. So when we talk about refugees, we also look at the potential that immigrants' vote is for us in the community. For example, in 2013, 19.3 million immigrants were naturalized in the United States. That represents 6% of the U.S. population. That's according to the American Community Survey. And if you look at the numbers, I mean, these are huge numbers. 779,929 people became green card holders in 2013. But with all these big numbers, I have the example of North Carolina. But you look at the percentage of people that are voting. In 2014, 36.4% of eligible voters actually voted, which is considered to be the lowest since 1942. But looking at the numbers of refugees and immigrants who are becoming citizens, you know, there's a huge potential through civic engagement for us to really bring about the change in our communities through voter education, voter registration, and encouraging refugees and new Americans in our community to come out and vote. Next slide, please. So what happens when people who have been impacted start leaving their voice? And people start to get a sense of their own power, of course. The more people are involved in the political process, participating in voting, that indicates that their people are getting more integrated. And developing a voting bloc changes political power relationship. And the reason why I say this is because when we do our training, we have people with different experiences, refugees from different walks of life, some of them educated, some of them not as much, people who have different level of experience. So when communities come together and try to show that power in terms of number of voters, that results into some advocacy wins, and that's a way we can address local and national issues. If you look at the picture I have there of a broom, and broom symbolizes a lot of things, especially for immigrants. It's about unity. You know, you cannot break a broom that is so tight with one hand, but you can break one piece of that broom. So if people come together, they'll be able to bring a sweeping changes throughout their community by being together. So voting together really can bring about change. Next slide, please. So there are different events that happen and different opportunities for us to engage refugees in our community and encourage them to be more civically engaged. And one of the events is the World Refugee Day, which is a great time to register and educate voters, particularly refugees who we highlight their contribution during this day. One way we have been doing is to recruit volunteers within the refugee community and train them on how to do voter registration, doing role play, and we have simplified scripts where they will go through and practice on how to really register people to vote. And one important tool that we have is the Commit to Vote card, which we have developed a way to remind refugees, people to come out and vote. And this card is simple. We just have their names, their email, their phone number, and when the election period is closed, so when it's close to election day, we will mail that card to them as a way to remind them or even give them a call to ask them if they are ready to vote or if they have voted. And voter registration is not only for somebody who is a U.S. citizen, because many of the refugee leaders will say, well, I'm not a U.S. citizen yet. I still have 3 or 5 years to go. But many in my community are citizens. So we let them reassure them that, well, you don't have to be a U.S. citizen. Anybody can vote. Anybody can register somebody to vote. You just have to make sure that they are U.S. citizens, that they meet certain requirements which are listed on this slide. So they can still contribute by educating their community, making sure that people are aware of the early voting days and help. Somebody mentioned in one of the earlier slides, printing out the voter guide, the ballot sample is really important to get people out to vote. Next slide, please. So getting out the vote, now that we've registered new citizens during the World Refugee Day, for example, or during one of the naturalization ceremonies that are happening in the community, we have to encourage folks to come out and vote. And we have to understand that because of the past traumas and also the sophistication of our voting system here, I myself, I'm voting for the first time this year, and I'm still kind of anxious about, okay, how am I going to be able to vote? So for refugees who have never voted ever in their lives or even never used any sophisticated machine to vote, it's really important for us, for example, during the soul to the polls, during congregation, when we encourage people to go out to vote, or when we use the organizing, carpooling to take refugee or immigrants in our community or congregation to go out to vote, to really help them understand that how the system works, and maybe even do a kind of practice of what they should be expecting when they go to the polling station is really important. So that's what I mean by solidarity at the poll. So in terms of the work we do, this is how we try to provide the tool for refugee and immigrant leaders themselves, because they know their community better than we do. And I think it's a great way for us to continue to engage our refugee community. I end my presentation here because I know we're running out of time. Thank you.
Thank you so much for that great information. So up next, we have Adam Waters, who is from the Religious Action Center of Reformed Judaism, who's going to talk to us a little bit about the Voting Rights Act and what that has to do with all of what we're talking about now. So I'll go ahead and hand it over to him. Adam, take it away.
Great. Thanks so much, Diana, and thanks to all the other panelists. This has been a really great webinar so far. So now that we've discussed some of the best practices to engage in voter mobilization and engagement efforts in relationship with immigrant and refugee communities, I want to just take a couple of minutes to step back and think about the wider political context in which we find ourselves and which makes this work so critical. So 2016 is a presidential election year, of course, but it is not an ordinary election year. This is actually the first presidential election year since 1965 in which we don't have the full protections of the Voting Rights Act. And so the Voting Rights Act of 1965, or the VRA, was designed to guarantee voting protections for all Americans in a variety of ways. And I'll just name two essential components of the Voting Rights Act. So the first, Section 2 of the VRA, protected all Americans from certain voting practices that would discriminate based on race or membership in a language minority group. And the second was Section 5, which required certain states and local jurisdictions that had a history of voter suppression to seek pre-clearance from the federal government, so to ask the federal government before changing their voting laws. And it was Section 4B of the Voting Rights Act that provided a formula that would determine which states and local jurisdictions were subject to this preclearance requirement. However, in 2013, the Supreme Court issued a 5-4 decision in the case Shelby County versus Holder, which, while upholding the constitutionality of Section 5, so saying that the preclearance requirements in theory was constitutional, it said that Section 4B, the formula to decide who was subject to preclearance, was outdated and thus unconstitutional. Basically, this meant that Section 5 is no longer enforceable. And as a result, 9 states and additional jurisdictions in 7 other states that had been subject to preclearance before 2013 are now able to make changes to their voting laws without federal approval. So you go to the next slide. And so immediately following the Shelby decision, several states passed or enacted voter restriction legislation. I'll just give 2 brief examples. So in North Carolina, for example, in the months after the Shelby decision, the state government enacted House Bill 589, a voting overhaul bill that included provisions to shorten early voting, eliminate same-day registration, require photo identification to vote, and end early voting registration for high school students. And in Texas, we had Senate Bill 14, a stringent voter photo identification law, which was passed in 2011, but held up in court, in federal court, until the 2013 Shelby decision. After that decision, the Texas state government immediately announced that it would enact this voter ID law. In all, voters in 16 states will face new voting restrictions for the first time in a presidential election in 2016. These are states all over the country, geographically diverse states, and there will be voting restrictions, new voting restrictions in 16 of them. Next slide. And I think it's important to understand, when talking about voting restriction laws, that these laws impact all American citizens by limiting the right to vote, but that they disproportionately affect certain groups of people. So people of color, the poor, the elderly, students, language minority groups, and immigrant and refugee communities are most likely to be affected by these changes, whether because they lack the necessary photo identification, lack the means to acquire that identification, don't have voter materials provided for them in their primary language, or for many other reasons. And critically, I think that we cannot successfully advance the work of creating a humane and functioning immigration system if the voters who have directly experienced the failures of that system find their fundamental democratic right to vote limited by voter restriction laws that we see being enacted throughout the country. Next slide. So the question then is, what are we going to do about it? How are we going to respond to this new wave of voter restrictions? And so on a legislative level, last year, the Voting Rights Advancement Act, or VRAA, was introduced in Congress, in the House and in the Senate, to restore the Voting Rights Act of 1965. And in particular, what the VRAA would do is create a new formula for preclearance that would replace Section 4B, the section that was struck down by the Supreme Court, and that would thus restore the power of Section 5, the preclearance requirement. However, given the short legislative calendar, given different priorities in Congress this year, and given the polarized politics of this Congress, it's relatively unlikely that the VRAA will pass this year. As such, new restrictions, these restrictions that we talked about in North Carolina, Texas, and all across the country, will be in place in the 2016 presidential election. And so while we must continue to push for passage of the Voting Rights Advancement Act in order to restore the Voting Rights Act, that's the long-term goal, that's what we hope for, we recognize that in this year, in 2016, voter engagement and voter mobilization are imperative to overcome restrictions to the right to vote and to make the voices of those who demand a more humane immigration system heard in this election cycle. And so I hope that that gives you just a general sense of why this work is so critical now and why we really have to be engaging in our congregations, in our faith communities, and also in partnership with immigrant and refugee communities in order to do this work of voter engagement. And so I will turn it back over to Diana.
Thank you, Adam. That was a really great summary of why we need to really care about the Voting Rights Act and the impact that it has really this election year. So now we're just going to go over a list of resources. No need to frantically write all this down. Again, this will all be available online afterward, but I just wanted to briefly talk about, especially since we just talked about the Voting Rights Act and how important that is, many of you may already be aware of this, but mid-April, we're actually going to have a conference here in Washington, D.C. called Ecumenical Advocacy Days, where this year's theme is Lift Every Voice, Racism, Class, and Power. And we're going to have a lobby day after learning all about these different issues. And our domestic ask is going to be for Congress to pass the Voting Rights Act and to restore the Voting Rights Act. And so I really encourage you all to visit that website and see how you can get involved with this movement. Next slide, please. And so here are just some toolkits that are available for you all to take a look at. These are some really great resources that you guys can feel free to check out later. They are very detailed. They have a lot of great specific ideas that you can incorporate into your congregations. And some are very specific to working with immigrant and refugee populations. So again, I really encourage you to check out these resources. Now, acknowledging that we are just a little bit over time. Oh, sorry, one more slide. And these are some really great resources on holy days and holidays that are coming up and have a great impact in our communities and some great resources that you can use in your congregations. I really encourage you to take a look at those and see if anything is useful for your congregations. And now recognizing that we have...
Brief. There's something that... This is Noel Anderson with Church World Service. Mentioned something that came up really just in the last couple days that the House Judiciary Committee is considering some really anti-refugee legislation. And this type of legislation would essentially create continual surveillance for and would significantly delay or even limit and cap resettlement for Central Americans, Syrians, and Iraqis, amongst many others. It would really lower the numbers of refugees resettled. And it would do a lot of other really bad things, like discriminate against Muslims by making it only Christian minorities that we would accept. And so we're asking everybody to call this number 1-866-940-2439 and get patched into your representative. If you go on the Interfaith Immigration Coalition website, please go to this link at interfaithimmigration.org/recent-legislation, and you will see our action alert, and we're targeting the House Judiciary Committee, and we're trying to get them to vote no on this really bad anti-refugee bill, and you'll find more details there. And that will be this Wednesday that they're scheduled to hear to consider voting on this really bad bill.
Thank you, Noel, for that great update. So now recognizing that we are running a little behind on time, folks, we are just going to take just a few minutes for a Q&A. If you guys have a question, you can press *6 and unmute your line and ask your question, or you can use that green little chat box at the top and type in your question for our speakers. So if you have a question, go ahead and unmute your phone right now, and we will be taking those questions.
*6, right?
Hello?
Is someone on the line with a question?
You have to press star 6 if you want to be able to speak.
Yes, star 6 and we'll all be able to hear you.
Hello, this is Rylan from Kentucky. I was wondering, I wasn't on like the original invite for this webinar, but I find it extremely useful in my position. How will I be able to access the information afterwards?
Great question. So we are actually going to follow up with an email for those who did RSVP, but if you didn't, you can go to immigrationcoalition.com and you can find it under the section for webinars.
Okay.
Or you can, if you would like to just go ahead and type in your email address into this little chat box, we can add you to the list of emails that we'll send out with a follow-up information.
Okay. Thanks a lot.
No problem. Are there any other questions? Again,
this is Rylan again. I can ask another one. Nobody else wants to jump in. The toolkit that the grassroots organizers through CWS have, I haven't looked at it myself yet, but does it go sort of beyond just like voting and registration in terms of like very, very, I don't know, basic, just how to get people to show up for anything? Any kind of meeting about policies or issues that are affecting their, like, neighborhood, communities, schools, stuff like that?
Yeah, this is Noel. I'm the grassroots coordinator for Church World Service, and we do have a number of toolkits that address, you know, how can we essentially mobilize our community and build teams about advocacy and community organizing. So, you know, be happy to try to connect you with the right resources or have a phone call about, you know, what methodologies and tactics are most helpful.
That would be great. We're actually creating a new position that's just going to start this Wednesday to specifically mobilize refugee groups across the state of Kentucky. So that would be perfect for
great,
her.
Great, yeah. I mean, I know you might be in touch with Jen Smyers, but my email and cell phone is usually tagged at the bottom of all of these emails about the webinars and whatnot.
Okay, thank you.
Great, thanks. Does anyone else have any other questions? Just press star 6.
Oh.
If there are no more questions, then I think that will be a wrap. Thank you all for taking the time out of your day to join us for this webinar. I know we had a lot of great speakers with a lot of great information, so we will be sure to follow up with everyone and send you this PowerPoint and as well as the audio for it. So if you missed that on the beginning portion for audio issues and technology issues, don't you worry, it'll be online so you can listen to it later. So thank you again for joining us. I hope you all have a great day.